Welcome one and all to an exciting, nay, apocalyptic episode of The Damage Report. We got some serious climate change news to get into today, but don't worry, we've got some good news as well. And the first bit of good news, my co-host, Evelina Sabrina, back once again. How's it going, Sabrina?
Good morning, John. Good morning, dragons.
Very glad to have you here. It's been a little bit since we spoke. And in that interim, there's been some good news. There was student debt cancellation. I think it's probably the IRA, I think, was passed since then. It's been like a banner period in political news. What have you been up to since last we spoke?
Oh, it's definitely been a nice change. Seeing some positive stuff come out of the White House, especially the Twitter thread of them calling out the Republicans who had their PPP loans forgiven. Just that was love to see it. More of that, please.
Yeah, it was nice. And not just for what happened, but because, you know, maybe it shouldn't, but it like subtly tweaks evaluations of what could happen. So like we've got a story coming up later on the show in the aftermath, where a politician is pressuring Biden to do a thing. And normally I'd be like, he ain't gonna do it. And now I'm like, he probably ain't gonna do it, but maybe. Because you never know, Dark Brandon, sometimes he wakes up and he chooses violence, we'll see. But anyway, very glad to have you here. And when I say that, I mean everyone. Thank you all for being here. If you wouldn't mind hitting the like button and sharing the stream, that'd be great so that people know we're live and they could join us as we talk through some good news, some bad news, some fun news, some light news, and even some animal news coming up in the aftermath. I am very excited for that. One of my favorite animal videos I've ever seen, we're gonna play in the aftermath today. And it's a hard hitter, I'll say that. But for now though, yes, you can send us messages. And with that, Sabrina, are you ready to talk about some news?
Let's go.
Okay, let's go. Unfortunately, we're starting off on the downside, but with that, let's jump into this video. What you're seeing is video out of Pakistan, the result of several months of heavy rainfall leading to an apocalyptic level of flooding. And that video is unbelievable. I'm sure you've seen others. We'll go to some as we discuss this, but almost every bit of video looks like the end of the world. It looks like someone is recreating biblical scenes, but in the present day. And this is not something that we are simply looking back on in horror. This is an incident that is still ongoing. There are people struggling and dying in this situation in Pakistan, literally as we speak, people desperately in need of help. Help that is beginning to come, but perhaps far too slowly. As of right now, 1/3 of Pakistan is submerged by historic flooding. At least 1,136 people have died since the monsoon season began just a couple of months ago. 75 were reported dead in just the past 24 hours. And those are the official death tolls. But I've got news for you. When a country is gripped by a crisis like this, when so many people have been driven from their homes, they might still be on the run from these conditions, when roads have been destroyed, when homes have been destroyed, how are you supposed to know who has actually died? And so the true numbers will only come in, if they ever come in, over time. But as of right now, estimates say 300,000 homes destroyed, obviously destruction of infrastructure, including the electrical grid, roads made impassable. 1 in 7 Pakistanis has been affected by this. This is literally tens of millions of people. And I wanna show you just a little bit more of the scale of the damage that we're talking about. Take a look at this. just incredible to see. And you know, of course, we're gonna be talking about climate change because flooding happens. Monsoon season didn't start 10 years ago, but it is made worse in the same way that virtually every natural disaster is made worse as climate change becomes worse. The dry season becomes drier, the wet season becomes wetter, the heat becomes worse, the cold becomes worse. It is important that we understand the nature of the challenge that we face, and it's being played out right now. Not someday climate change will be bad. It's bad right now as we're filming this. Sabrina, what do you think of this?
That destruction is terrifying, and I feel like we're going to be seeing a lot about the people of Pakistan after this, because how many of those homes that are being absolutely destroyed, how many of them are actually going to be rebuilt? It's going to take a really long time. People are going to have to, you know, migrate further out if they survive. It's going to be a bad thing, and we're going to keep hearing about it, I think. And not even just Pakistan, but you know, climate change is causing these catastrophic events way more often than we used to see. Like events like this that would maybe only be like every 100 years or so, they're happening like happening on an annual basis. This is not normal. This is not okay, and it's just going to keep getting worse. So I'm quite worried that this is a glimpse into the future.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look, the infrastructure isn't made to deal with these things. It's not made to deal with this level of flooding. We saw in the UK and France and Spain, the heat waves literally melting infrastructure. Our world is not created for these conditions. And thinking that like climate change is only going to result in some polar bear like floating on a little ice cap, like it's going to happen over there. It's not. It's going to happen literally everywhere. Our ability to produce food, to have drinkable water, as we'll get into, is being affected already. Now, we've had in the US, thankfully, the IRA passed. It's historic climate change legislation, but that's only in comparison to what has been done in the past, which is effectively nothing. Far more needs to be done by our country, by countries around the world. In the meantime, though, since these sorts of incidents are unavoidable, they are coming and they will continue to come, we need to do something to help people. People of Pakistan need help right now. Right now, Sherry Rehman, the climate minister of Pakistan, says that they've deployed the Navy inside of the country because the interior of the country right now looks like a small ocean. And to give you an example, sort of wide scale of the damage that was done, this is getting to what Sabrina was saying about, you know, will these buildings be reconstructed? Take a look at this satellite footage showing us it is March 24th. You can see, and then August 28th, it's just nothing effectively. That place is now gone. And in theory, maybe some of that will come back, but it's gonna be difficult, especially because Pakistan right now, they're talking about multiple of their crops that have been completely wiped out, their cotton crop, vegetable, fruit, and rice fields. So that's people's livelihood. That's also the economy of a country that has been severely handicapped at exactly the worst time for it. They're saying, they're estimating in terms of what they will need to rebuild, they're saying $10 billion potentially, although, you know, who knows? The incident is still continuing, the damage could grow worse. We did have an announcement from the US Agency for International Development right before we went live. They were announcing $30 million in life-saving humanitarian assistance to help people affected by the flooding, which is great and will do some good. But $30 million versus estimates of $10 billion. Like really, is this to the scale of what we need? And hopefully, if enough people pay attention to this and if it stays a concern internationally, then the UN will do something. There will be pressure on the US to act and to send more money. We've shown recently, by the way, as a country, we can send tens of billions of dollars, for instance, to Ukraine in the form of weapons, aid that they desperately need. Can we do it in this case when it's water that we're fighting rather than Russia? That's what I would like to see. Sabrina, any other thoughts?
I mean, I don't know if we're going to send that much money, you know, 30 million. Great, not close to the 10 billion. I don't think that the US would actually send more unless it actually starts to negatively affect this country. So that's just the way this country kind of typically goes. I'm not so hopeful, and it's very sad.
Water troubles continue, not just in Pakistan. But here in the US, take a look at what's going on in Mississippi right now. So absolutely insane flooding happening right there. An abundance of water, not an abundance of usable water though. So in Jackson, Mississippi, they have little or no water pressure in homes after the city's main water treatment facility failed at the beginning of this week. So right now, according to the governor who put out a statement, perhaps trying to draw some national attention to this, you can't flush toilets, you can't fight fires there, and fires can be a consequence of flooding. Reeves announced that the city is failing to produce running water. By the way, they already had issues. For about a month, there was a boil water notice, and residents were told to conserve what water they did have. So it was already an issue, but now, this is again, like I don't know why it would be better if it were somewhere else, but we're used to saying that it's some other country that's having this experience, the complete catastrophic failure of infrastructure. Again, in a very real sense, a destruction of the capacity to maintain human life. No, it's here, it's happening in Mississippi, and again, it's flooding. Mississippi has had flooding, Mississippi will always have flooding, but the flooding becomes worse thanks to climate change. And again, it's not in the future, it's happening right now. Now, unfortunately, they have Tate Reeves. So what are the odds that he's gonna get that he's gonna come out of this crisis with a newfound respect for the scale, the scope of this climate crisis, and a desire to work inside of Mississippi and with the federal government to deal with it? I'm sort of doubting that that's gonna happen. I'm doubting that there's gonna be much of a concern about increased resiliency of things like their ability to produce water. But for rational people, this would be a great time to take this in, to learn from it, and have it inform our politics going forward. Sabrina, what are your thoughts?
I'm concerned with the displacement that this is also going to cause, like in Mississippi. Like if you're going to continue to not have drinkable, usable water, even to like flush the toilets and whatnot, and there's flooding going on, I'm worried that this is just going to displace like a lot of people, because Do we actually think that, you know, the representatives in that area are going to try and fix this for the long term? I don't think so. This doesn't happen that much in richer neighborhoods. And if it does, the problem actually gets fixed right away, as opposed to like maybe poorer communities like this one in Mississippi. Probably not so much. People are just going to continue to suffer.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, I mean the fact that it took literally years to deal with the situation of the, you know, totally avoidable water issues, for instance, in Flint. If that was 90210, it wasn't gonna be that way. First of all, they'd have the finest water shipped to them on a daily basis, but those pipes would be fixed, and that's fundamentally the issue. There's certainly the class inequity here, you know, tied in with the fact that this is the US, so there's gonna be racial inequities too in terms of infrastructure, but also, even if this weren't a climate thing, this is an ideology thing. It's not like on both sides of the aisle, there's an equal respect for the ethical obligation of the government to function. What is the government supposed to do? What it's not supposed to do in times that are easy, economically, in terms of public health, in terms of environmental disaster, then maybe it doesn't seem that critical where you stand on that question. But when the flooding starts, whether you think the government should function or not, whether you think of the government as a safety net to protect the most vulnerable from the worst outcomes, or if you view it as an unfortunate necessity to keep the peasantry in line, but if you could really keep your hands out of our pockets and away from our corporations, that would be ideal. Well, suddenly that gap feels pretty damn significant. It feels like the difference between life and death, and for some people just might be. Now here, thankfully, the level of the crisis, the lack of access to water, that can be compensated for in the short term. You can move water over by truck and those sorts of things. But you know, like we've experienced things like in New Orleans, like we know how significant this can get. And it shouldn't take crises at that level to get people to start to center this stuff in their politics. Something only as bad as this could be a reminder of how important it is that the government actually functions and that it centers the needs of real working people, not just the rich, in choosing how it does its budget, how it spends money, and all of that. And so hopefully this will be a reminder. Hopefully the people of Jackson will get prompt assistance. But Sabrina, do you know that we have yet more water news for you?
Because and it's gonna keep coming.
It is, exactly. Some days we focus on fire, some days on water. It's like the Avatar The Last Airbender method of creating show rundowns. We'll get to you, Earth. But for now, let's talk about other ice. Greenland is gonna melt. It's apparently just going to happen. And I don't mean if we don't do what we need to do. No, apparently, no matter what we do, we've got an issue coming. And the issue is zombie ice, which is not another needless spin-off of The Walking Dead. No, it's there, it's real, and it is scary. So right now, it's estimated that Greenland melting, the ice sheet there melting, is going to raise the global sea level at least 10.6 inches, which is a lot. And it is, in fact, twice what was previously estimated. And this is not a thing that we are apparently going to be able to avoid by taking the climate crisis more seriously in the short term, switching over to electric vehicles and all that because of the zombie ice. So what is that? Well, it's a doomed ice that, while still attached to thicker areas of ice, is no longer being replenished by parent glaciers, now receiving less snow thanks to climate change. Because it's not being replenished, the doomed ice is melting from climate change and will inevitably raise seas. And we cannot, in the short term, repair Greenland, or I guess the climate's ability to renew that zombie ice. And so it is going to be raising the sea levels. The estimate puts it at 10.6. That's a lot. That would be absolutely catastrophic for a number of parts of the world. That's not the high end of the estimates, by the way. Some estimate, including there was a report in the Journal of Natural Climate Change, said it could reach as much as 30 inches. I mean, just absolutely amazing. And that's if we're responsible. That's with us being kind of responsible, at least insofar as we have the IRA. And so again, that we've got issues in Pakistan, we've got issues in Mississippi, and now coastlines around the world about to get a gradual hit over the next few decades, Sabrina.
See, this is why I wasn't super duper excited over Manchin's bill that passed, where we got just like a scrap of money to put towards climate change while at the same time continuing to like help prop up like oil and whatnot. Like, as long as we continue to prop up these fossil fuels, we are going to continue to see this destruction. We are going to continue to see, you know, loss of drinkable water and whatnot. It's not going great. We need to take away this profit motive when it comes to fossil fuels. I'm pessimistic.
Exactly, 100%. And we're seeing some movement. For instance, when it comes to like non-fossil fuel burning vehicles, California is going to be doing that relatively rapid phase in. That could have ripple effects throughout the country, so that's good. But obviously, that's just one part of it. I mean, we're talking about power generation, we're talking about animal agriculture, we're talking about a lot of things like that, air travel, international cargo ships, and there's a lot of things that need to be tackled simultaneously. I want to touch base with one more thing, though, because I've cited multiple times this 10.6 inches. So there's Ellen Enderlin, is a geosciences professor at Boise State University, says that might not sound like much, but this would be over and above high tides and storms, which makes them worse. This is going to have a huge societal, economic, and environmental impact. And look, exactly why a certain number of inches isn't necessarily only as bad as it might seem. Like, you could go to the beach and imagine the water being 10 inches higher. Explaining exactly why that's not actually how it works is complex, and we eventually butt up against even my understanding of the climate science. But what I do understand is that, for instance, when you talk about the rise in the average temperature, often when we throw those numbers around, they seem relatively small, a half a degree, 1 degree, 1.5 degrees. You know, that's something. But you tick up the AC a little bit. Again, we're talking about averages. We're not talking about the extremes. And when you, on average, raise it that much, that's not what every part of the world will have at every part of the year. Those extremes become way more extreme in those instances. And that's true not only of temperature, but also of water. Storm surge, like long before Miami is literally underwater all of the time, it's gonna be underwater a lot of the time, because that's the way storm surges and hurricanes work. And again, every component of this, whether it's temperature, average sea level, intensity of storms, all of them are being made worse. All of them interact in some potentially horrific ways to produce some outcomes that we should really be trying harder to avoid. Any final thoughts on water, Sabrina?
Listen, if the houses on the coast go underwater, then people can just sell their houses to Aquaman. It's gonna be great.
Exactly. That dude is gonna have his pick of mansions. Anyway, you're joking there. Of course, that's basically what Ben Shapiro said. He didn't make it as pop culturally relevant with the Aquaman thing. But yes, that intellectual gladiator told people that they should just move once the sea level rise. They should just sell the house, because that's how that works. Anyway, with that said, we're gonna go to our first break. We come back. I did not expect in the news mad libs that we're often presented with that Donald Trump, Emmanuel Macron, and details of a sex life was the news we're gonna be faced with today. But that's what we've got, so we'll address it after this. Okay, everybody, let's talk some more news. What kind of information did Donald Trump have in those hundreds of classified documents that he worked so hard to keep his hands on? What was he doing taking those documents abroad when he was president? Why this guy who has never read a book had to bring boxes of classified documents with him when he traveled abroad? What was that about? Well, we don't know for sure. But there are some theories, and they have to do with a small scandal apparently that happened back when he was president. It involved the fact that he apparently often bragged to his closest associates, both during and after his time in the White House, that he knew illicit details about the love life of French President Emmanuel Macron. This is according to two different people talking to the outlet Rolling Stone. The former president apparently even claimed that he learned about some of this dirt through, quote, intelligence he had seen or been briefed on. This is the first ever time that we've had confirmed that Donald Trump paid attention during a briefing and retained the knowledge that was given to him. Now, exactly why sex life details, Emmanuel Macron, would have been presented during one of these briefing sessions, I have no idea. But the fact that that was what piqued his interest, I find very easy to believe. Now, there are multiple sources on this information. That does not mean that it is 100% solid. We would want to ideally know who those sources are, but this is what we're learning. It's apparently not clear whether the Macron related documents the FBI seized had anything to do with his personal life. It could be that those are separate things, but we do know that that's one of the individuals who was referenced in these documents. It's also not clear whether the information on Macron seized from Mar-a-Lago was derived from US intelligence collection or even classified. Why exactly Donald Trump would go to this much trouble to maintain non-classified documents about Macron, I don't know. And why the FBI would have seized them if they were non-classified is an interesting follow-up question. But we're trying to figure this out. What we do know is that after, when he was president, he was bragging about this stuff. Apparently, he said he knew naughty details that few knew. Don't use the word naughty. Don't do that, Trump, please. I want to use it someday, and now I'm not interested. Both French and US officials worked to figure out what he knew, how he knew it, how sensitive it was. And the officials in both nations wanted to know if the discovery signified some kind of national security breach. And look, you might say, well, how could it possibly do that? This is about sex life stuff. Yeah, that's true. But how would you get that information? Do you have a source embedded close to this world leader? Are you intercepting communications? Are you hacking into servers or computers? I mean, the only ways that you would get that information are also probably really good ways to get information that's non-sexual, that might be about national security. And so you can understand why both the US as well as French authorities were a little bit worried about this. Now, we have more on the history of Donald Trump being super thrilled about having dirty details about individuals. But Sabrina, what do you think about this? Does this make it better or worse than if the documents are about nuclear weapons?
The thing is, it's weird that he would brag about it. Like, it makes him sound worse than whatever he could possibly know about Macron's sex life. I mean, unless there's something like illegal about it, which I think if there was, then we would have found out by now. So if it's just like some kinky stuff or something, then that kind of makes Trump look like the weirder person to really hold on to that.
I think 100%. I will say, This almost makes me feel a little bit better about the situation from a national security perspective, a little bit worse from a we want to get you sucka perspective, which is that it is plausible to me that Donald Trump would want to maintain the hard copies of stuff about little naughty details he's not supposed to know. And if that is actually what he knew, and if it's not about here is where our missile defense launchers are, then that's way better for the country. It's still illegal. You still can't have that information, and it reflects super poorly on him. But I feel better politically in terms of whether this will result in Donald Trump going to prison. I think that the odds of that, no matter what, are pretty low. I would assume if this is what those documents were primarily concerned about, then it would be lower. And honestly, it's got to be a mix of the two. You don't have hundreds of documents about Macron's sex life. That seems inconceivable, unless that guy is way busier than I imagine he is. In any event, when Trump would brag about Macron and what he knew, he was apparently often light on details and specifics. It's often, one source said, hard to tell if it's bull-ass or not. So it's possible that the details were as vague as they caught some sort of sext or something, or they saw a photo, or it could be something like that. It doesn't have to be super detailed. It's not like necessarily that they have videos or something like that. But of course, Trump is going to be obsessed with this. You probably remember earlier in the primary cycle, there was the primary battle between JD Vance and Josh Mandel. So Trump apparently heard some sexual details about one of them that he thought were disgusting, and that apparently informed his actual endorsement. And that's not the only election that was informed in that way. And so the idea that Trump would go to extreme lengths for material like this, I think incredibly plausible. I wonder though, if this is going to result in the right, like a new defense of the right as to why the FBI shouldn't have prioritized this. Maybe they want it to be a story about this, Sabrina. I wonder.
I hope not. Oh my gosh. Why are they making like such a big deal out of this little story? And yet there are other representatives who have much more questionable, possibly illegal things regarding their own spicy lives, whatever you want to call it. And that doesn't seem to get nearly as much attention. So yeah, this seems like a silly, silly story.
Yeah, yeah, we'll see, we'll see. Anyway, with that, we are burning hour. So I think we're gonna have to prep for our C block. You wanna give me a little thumbs up when we're ready to go for that? And oh, we're ready to go for that? Okay, I'm gonna read a comment or two and then we'll jump back to it. First of all, I wanna recognize McBain over on Twitch, who's been with us for 25 months and says, what do you say, Dragon Daddy? Does Dark Brandon, if he keeps up the bit of fieriness, deserve an honorable spot in the Dragon Squad? And if so, what will his dragon name be? I'm not necessarily ready to talk about that. I do like that he got some climate legislation passed. That puts him above most presidents. I assume he would be Malarkey Dragon, but we can talk that out on the chat. We'll see going forward. For now though, let's get ready for this, because actually very recently I was lucky enough to sit down with Representative Hank Johnson, who has a bill to radically reform the SCOTUS. And that is going forward one of the most important things for the Democrats to prioritize. And so I want to make sure that you see this talk we have, because it could be important for informing that debate going forward. Here is my talk with Representative Hank Johnson. Most people seem to agree that the Supreme Court is in a bit of a legitimacy crisis, and you can probably fill in for yourself any number of different reasons why that is. Obviously, there's been a lot of focus on SCOTUS after the repeal of Roe v. Wade, but the nomination process has been a mess for a number of years. The high stakes nature of winning the presidency so that you can get justices just in case, timing when they retire or if they might die, the entire thing is a big mess. The thing is, there are multiple plans for how you could reform the SCOTUS so that it could do its job with a little bit less chaos sort of baked into the process. And we're very lucky to be joined on the program today by Congressman Hank Johnson, who has a bill to do that, to reform the SCOTUS. Congressman, welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you, great to be with you.
It's great to have you here. We've been talking about the need for reform in the SCOTUS for some time on the show. And so tell us a little bit about your bill. How would it change the Supreme Court?
Well, the Supreme Court Tenure Establishment and Retirement Modernization Act, also known as the TERM Act, would establish an 18-year term limit for justices of the United States Supreme Court. They would rotate on for 18 years and they would rotate off after 18 years of service. And once we get to the point where we have no judges who have signed, who have served longer than 18 years, that would be at the point where every 2 years a judgeship or a justiceship on the Supreme Court would turn over. And that way you would give each presidential term two appointments to the United States Supreme Court. And we would infuse the court with a little modernity, a little fresh air, and a little more accountability to the American people. Right now, with there being no term limits and with a court that has been packed with right-wing extremist judges, you know, it's clear that there is no accountability. These justices can do whatever they want. They can impose their draconian views on everyone else. We don't vote for them. We can't vote them out of office. The only way we can get them out of office is to impeach them. And we've seen how difficult that is to impeach, convict, and remove. So in order to bring the court up to modern standards and to protect it from itself, because at this point it has delegitimized itself with its rulings, with its right-wing extremist rulings over the past few years, particularly over the last term of the court, we're trying to save the court from itself and restore the ability of the people to have confidence and trust in the rule of law as established by the United States Supreme Court.
Okay, so as you laid out, you know, once you're fully through to this system being how everyone got on the court, you'd have some predictability, regularity. Every term you'd get two changes to the court. So until we get to then, what would happen to the current sitting justices?
Well, when they reached, or once the legislation becomes effective, once it's passed by the House and Senate and signed by the president, then any justice who has served in excess of 18 years would automatically be out sitting on the Supreme Court as an active justice. They would go on senior status and they would be available to fill in for a justice in case there was a vacancy on any particular decision due to recusal or some other cause of there being less than nine justices to decide a case. Okay. And a new justice would be appointed to replace the justice who would have been timed out by this legislation. So there would be no retroactivity under this legislation. And we would begin the process of replacing justices with a new justice. And that new justice would have an 18-year term until they termed out.
Okay. I want to get your opinion about some of the criticisms that I've heard or that we can reasonably predict for this. So President Biden had a panel that looked into, you know, relatively early on in his presidency, possible reforms. And they seemed open to several of them. They did say, though, having it be this regularly scheduled thing that happens every 2 years, they worry that that could lead to positions on the Supreme Court becoming an even bigger concern during elections. That doesn't really seem, I think, reasonable to me, but I'm curious what you think about how this changeover would affect the way people see the Supreme Court when it comes to their vote.
Well, the barn door has already been opened on that, and all of the animals have escaped the barn. So you can't close the barn door and stop the harm that has been caused already. Unfortunately, as you pointed out at the top of your segment, the politicization of the Supreme Court is nothing new. It has commenced in full throttle in recent years with how the game of appointment is being played, appointments and confirmations. And we've even seen the outsourcing of the last three justices to the Federalist Society, a private political group that has been influencing politics in America. That is their stated intent. And they have been given the role of approving or recommending justices to the United States Supreme Court, as they have done with lower court judges for decades now. And so that process has been totally politicized before it even gets to the Senate, which then has a process that is political, where the potential justice comes and sits down and looks everybody in the eye and says, I believe in precedent. And you know, and then once seated, proceeds to do what they have been trained to do and what they were put on the court to do by the interests that put them on the court. And and then the senators, even Mitch McConnell, deciding that I'm not going to even have a confirmation process for a particular justice because it's the last year of the Obama administration and we're in an election year. And so as a matter of policy, we have a new one, and that is we're not going to consider any appointments of justices to the highest court of the land during an election year. And then in the very next election, flips that rule on its head, and within days of the election, ushers through the appointment of the Honorable Amy Coney Barrett as a justice on the United States Supreme Court, after which he invites her to his to the Mitch McConnell whatever it was. They had some kind of event, political event in Kentucky, at a place that's named for him. And here is the Honorable Amy Coney Barrett announcing to the public that it's a lie that Supreme Court justices are acting in a political manner. So, you know, politics has infected this court to the point where those who have been infected don't even realize that they've been infected. Mm-hmm. So we've got to do something about this, and that's what the Term Act will do.
Okay. Yeah, the current system influences in a political direction so many different things, up to and including the why you would choose one justice over another. The fact that they serve lifetime terms incentivizes choosing someone that's as young as possible. But obviously, if you want to have someone with a lot of experience and wisdom and experience, that should influence you in the opposite direction, but clearly it doesn't. I want to jump to the path to getting it potentially passed, because I think it probably goes without saying that many Republicans will not be a fan of this. Although it is difficult to imagine what about the proposed system that you're talking about has any sort of political bias whatsoever, unless it's biased towards advantaging a party that can win presidential elections. I suppose the Republicans might be a bit sensitive about that, considering their difficulty getting a majority of the country to support them. But how are you going to get this through in the House, in the Senate? How does this become law?
Yeah, I think Democrats by and large are not in favor of politicizing the court any more than it has been politicized. And we respect the rule of law, we respect judicial independence, and we respect the ability of the and the need for the judiciary to be a co-equal branch of government, rather than one that is subservient to either the executive or legislative branch or both. And so let's start out with that premise. We want to fix the court, we want to unpack the court. And this is what Republicans have done to our courts, and it's something that we need to correct. And yeah, you're right, Republicans have the court exactly where they want it, and they're not going to be favorable of change. And in fact, Republicans who used to call themselves the conservative party, I mean, conservatism means that we don't want to change anything. We want everything to remain exactly as it is. And in fact, That's what their Supreme Court does, is takes it all the way back to the minds of the framers of the Constitution, and they try to interpret the Constitution in accordance with whatever those framers of the Constitution, however lacking in diversity they were, notwithstanding the lack of diversity, but they try to get into the heads of what were they thinking and then rule accordingly. Our friends in the legislative branch on the Republican side would like for everything to be as it was, but unfortunately, everybody didn't have rights back then, and they still don't want us to have rights. That's why they are attacking our fundamental right to vote, in addition to taking away women's reproductive freedom. And they have on the agenda the rights of others as well that they want to clip or terminate. And so that is what Republicans do. I'm not expecting any support from them. What we must do is elect more Democrats. And even some of the Democrats have to be educated about the excesses of the court and why we need to change. But I'm looking forward to having those discussions.
I am as well. I mean, the main components of your bill, it's been my preferred path to Supreme Court reform. It seems the most equitable, fair, lets people, you know, sort of predict how the court is going to change over time. I think what we need is less chaos in politics, and I think that it would produce it. So, you know, I very much like the direction that you're going in there, and I obviously wish you and co-sponsors and all that the best of luck in getting it passed. Representative Hank Johnson, I want to thank you again for joining us and breaking down the bill.
Thank you very much for having me.
So yeah, I had a great talk with the representative. You know, I know there are a lot of different ways that people conceive of reform. Like this, for instance, doesn't change the total number of seats on the Supreme Court, which I know is a priority for some. I think this has as its core fairness. Like, this is what the system should have been. I think we could have avoided a lot of trouble if that's what the system was. And obviously, right now, non-starter, they're not going to get it passed. But getting more Democrats in office to potentially get it passed, having it be a priority for people when they're voting, these are important things because, you know, getting a progressive president would be great. There's still going to be a conservative Supreme Court for some time, an unrepresentative Supreme Court. Justices that were put on there by presidents that were not chosen by a majority of the people. So we need some reform, and hopefully we'll have it. For now, though, we do have to take our second break. We come back, we got some wild news to talk about, so don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a bit. I apologize. I was a very bad host in a behind the scenes sense. I don't know if it was clear from the rundown, but we can jump. Let's get ready to jump to the E block, I think, time wise. I think we can fit that in, and then we'll be able to get the D block is not being skipped, everyone. It will be coming later on. But when you're ready to go for the E block, let me know, okay? Okay. By the way, Ludicrous Speed Dragon, first of all, love the reference, and also thank you for gifting that sub over on Twitch. And with that, let's jump into this. Ben Shapiro recently took to social media to do two things I find at least semi-fascinating. The first is to throw Trump under the bus. That's fun, I'll take that. But he also accidentally revealed something really core and honest about what he thinks politics is truly about. And I think that's even spicier. But here's the beginning of the thread. He says the Republicans are losing steam in the 2022 election, which is true. There are some reasons for this, the Democratic upswing in the wake of Dobbs being the most obvious factor. But there's something else going on here that represents a deeper problem for the Democratic Party. For the Republican Party. First of all, I love that he just glosses over. He admits, oh, we overturned Roe v. Wade and that is hurting us across the country. Maybe this is an opportunity to learn something from that. Why is that hurting you across the country? Why is it that people didn't want that to happen? But he's moving on. He's not interested in that. He says there's a bunch of nonsense, and we're going to get to the point though. This means that when Trump is attacked, Republicans immediately return to making him the centerpiece of the conversation. And this harms them electorally, as every poll is now showing. I think he's largely right. They are universally defensive about Trump, and that doesn't necessarily seem to be helping them, although it does apparently help Trump. vis-a-vis other Republican candidates. Ben then says two things can be true at once. First, the FBI raid on Trump looks like a political hit. Second, the more Republicans talk about Trump, the worse they do electorally. I agree, two things can be true at once. Actually, more than two things can be true at once, and I'll prove it right now. The third thing that can be true is that Trump broke the law, and it's super weird that you don't even pause for a second on that possibility. Ben's just moving on. It's a political hit. It hurts the Republicans. Yeah, but what about the actual facts, the actual substance? Did he break the law literally hundreds of times by keeping documents that he had no right to have? Are you interested in that? Do you want to find out about that? You were freaked out about Hillary Clinton in the emails. Are you potentially interested in, no, you're not interested in the docs? Okay, Ben, we'll move on. And this is where he reveals himself. He says, Americans vote against things, not for them. If Republicans want Americans to vote against Biden, they have to campaign against him, not against the FBI or the deep state or on whether Trump had the right to have boxes of classified documents in his closet, which again, I really wish you would focus on. And look, I think maybe focusing more on Biden would be good for the Republicans, but that point there that I find fascinating, Sabrina, is he says Americans vote against things, not for them, which I think historically is pretty accurate. But is that what it should be? That is such a different question. And he's not questioning whether this is what the way things should be. He's just saying that's what it is. You vote against things, not for things. Why would you vote for things? Why would something be offered to you? I find that so interesting.
And that's why every election, everybody is so pessimistic. Everybody feels like they're forced between a rock and a hard place, as if it's almost, you know, not designed that way. You know, like people do end up voting against things. They do end up picking the lesser of two evils, and people don't want to vote like that anymore. And so they just won't. That's why voter turnout is always abysmal. So he's, man, I don't want to give him a W, but he's got something right.
Yeah, so I agree that he is identifying what's happening, but he's also identifying that he is fine with this. And of course he's fine with this. He doesn't want people to have the prospect of voting for something because he doesn't want there to be something for them to vote for. For implies that the government is doing something, offering something. The government, from the point of view of Ben Shapiro, is never supposed to do that. Certainly not for regular people. You know, every 8 years or so, when a Republican becomes president, despite never winning the majority of the vote, there are tax cuts for the rich. That's a thing that the government can offer. But not for regular people. The Democrats are supposed to vote against Trump. The Republicans are supposed to vote against, I don't know, trans swimmers or something. But always against people, never against something actually being offered. And I think that that's wrong. You'll notice he's not telling the Republicans to campaign on what they're gonna do, what they're gonna offer, what they're gonna change, the legislation they're gonna pass. He's just saying, don't hit the deep state, hit Biden directly, which is effectively the same thing. It's just say stuff. Don't do anything, don't offer anything, don't promise anything, just say things. And then one way that I think he does sort of get something wrong is, I'm gonna jump ahead to this last graphic, graphic six. He says, Democrats, we don't want to talk about Biden, the economy, our perversion of the education system, or Afghanistan. Let's talk about Trump. Republicans, great idea. Let's talk about Trump. Okay, but here's the thing. The Democrats actually have been doing some stuff recently. They passed that climate bill. They canceled student loan debt. Those are things that they do want to talk about. It's not that the Democrats don't want to talk about the education system. They want to talk about the fact that they just canceled that debt. It's Ben Shapiro that doesn't want them to talk about that. He wants it to be kept about personalities. Sabrina, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know what exactly he's talking about, as if like Republicans, that's a great idea. Let's talk about Trump. Like, I feel like that was a strategy even, you know, back when Trump was campaigning, you know, let's just talk about Trump and how ridiculous he is. But he's also forgetting to mention that that kind of backfired for Democrats as well. So I don't know why he's kind of poo-pooing on the Pied Piper strategy when it kind of worked for the Republicans before. I really don't know what he's trying to say.
I don't know. I'm not sure he does either. In any event, that's all the time we have for our first hour. There's a lot more news to get to, including fun animal news. So don't go anywhere. Sabrina will be back on the other side. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.